We had the rear seat gunners there, but they really.
But you were talking about the hits on the
well, flag. We. It was really the AA fire was really so intense that I don't think very many of the pilots. I know. I was concentrating solely on my the target, which was one of their CL carriers, not one of their big fleet carriers, it was a CL carrier, and I had no time to survey the horizon.
Wasn't much you could do about it anyway. It was.
And they was my wingman. He was shot down, and we did not know what happened to him till after the war. Then we found out he'd been picked up. He ditched in Curie Harbor, and he had a very interesting little anecdote about it, where he said he ditched in the harbor and he got out of his plane, he and his air crewman. And there was this Japanese boat rowed out there to pick him up. And he said, they didn't say a word, but they just rowed up alongside of him, and one picked up his oar and started hitting him over the head with it. Said, didn't say a word, but just started beating him over the head with the oar. But they took him back, and I guess he got pretty good treatment because they knew the war was getting down to the end. But anyway, we got out of the that was the only one we lost at the time, and we got back to the carrier, and we spent I guess about the same that was the same day that the Franklin got we were getting ready to take off on another strike. And we could see all the ECACFAR around through the amongst the other carriers, and the Franklin, we knew that she'd been hit because
she got a kamikaze.
Yeah, she got a kamikaze, and so we were up there, had about 40 planes on her deck, and getting ready to take off when we got the kamikaze alert, and we stayed there, I guess, for about 15 minutes warming up before they told us to cut the engines, go below. And about that time, they blew up a Betty about 50 yards off of our bow. They'd come in, you know, for a kamikaze attack. And then I think it was the next day, I'm not quite sure which, but we did get a kamikaze, took a kamikaze down in the number one elevator, and we had gone back down to Okinawa, and we were conducting support operations off Okinawa, and we spent about a week, 10 days there when we had and they were sending out these kamikazes just regularly, and we were lying off the coast there of Okinawa, and I guess it was we'd made about about 20 strikes. I think I was on 15 of them, and we made. I was normally ever rotating every other strike with the flight officer, and I think it was after about 15 strikes, then that's when we got kamikaze by a small Japanese plane, and he ended up down their number one flight well, started a fire, and we're on the hangar deck, and it got up to the flight deck, and we had to kick over about 12 or 14 of our aircraft, just dump them over the side. So that pretty much ended our operations, because they told us we could have continued under very marginal conditions, but they, I think they felt that the war might go on for some time, so they said, you head back to the States and get a repair.
Well, how much damage did it actually do?
Well, it knocked out all the forward part of the flight deck. In other words, the concussion came up from the elevator and blew out. It put the forward elevator completely out of commission.
Did you have much loss of men?
No, I think, if I recall, we only had, I don't think we had any people lost. There was a couple of minor injuries, but nobody's
lucky.
Lost no life.
Well, one thing you said when you were up, or it was when you were off of Curia Harbor, when you were talking about the Roosevelt, that y'all were getting ready to fly off the plane and they had you go below instead. It would seem to me that if they were anticipating a kamikaze attack, it would be better to have the planes in the air than on deck.
Well, there was two, I think there was probably two schools of thought on that. Was it was at the beginning of the launch operations, and I think the commanding officer didn't want to put himself into one position while he was launching those planes. He wanted to be free to do his maneuvering, you know, to avoid the kamikazes as they were coming in. And I can see his point, because when you start launching your aircraft, you're in irons on one course until you get them all off.
Right. But other than that, it would have been logical to have scrambled planes to have tried to take out the kamikaze from the air, wouldn't it?
Right. But we was normally launching very early in the morning, and those kamikazes would come in, and we were normally, the weather wasn't all that great. They were coming in under the overcast. They very inexperienced pilots. They didn't have the slightest clue as to anything except trying to find a ship and diving into it.
What I understood, just understand, they had very little training.
No, they didn't have any training, because on one of the intercept missions, when we were off of Okinawa there, one of the fighter cap went up, and on one mission he shot down 7 of these kamikazes. In the last one, he'd used up all of his ammunition in his plane. In the last one, he just pulled up alongside of him and pulled out his .45 and was shooting at him with his .45. And they did no maneuvering. They did nothing. They just went to find the ship, and of course that was triggered a very comical incident. The radar destroyers, you know, that as soon as they'd find a destroyer, their mission was a carrier, but if they'd find one of those destroyers, they'd dive into the destroyers. So we were refueling on one of our intervals, refueling, and destroyers were coming alongside for the carriers to refuel. Up on the conning tower, not the conning tower, but the bridge of the destroyer, there was a big old sign, and it had an arrow. It's a big old arrow. It said, "Carriers that way." And everybody got a big laugh out of that. But we went back to San Francisco and got our flight deck repaired, and was on our way back to and had just gotten back to Ulithi when we got the word, you know, the war had been terminated, and that really terminated the operations. We had we spent about 2 months or a month or 2 months covering the Marine landings up in Korea, in northern China. We went up and patrolled, sent patrols in off of China and over Shanghai, and Marines had made landings all up and down the coast there. And then after we covered those landings, we were got orders to the squadron to go back to a little island up there where we had a base, and we were to disband and leave the big carrier, and we landed we had orders then to go back to the States. Mm-hmm. And so we picked up a small Jeep carrier, and the whole squadron personnel was loaded aboard it, and we went back to San Francisco.
And just leave the planes up there?
Yeah, just left the planes and everything there. There was a new air group came out to relieve us, and so we went back to San Francisco, and I, on the way back, got orders to assignment as a navigator on the USS Anzio, which was a Jeep carrier. And I can go from there if you want to.
One question before we leave World War II. You were talking about your squadron attacking the Japanese ships there in Kure Harbor. How effective was the attack? Did you do damage?
We got several hits on, credited hits on the carrier, and we got some hits. There was a battleship in there. Some of the squadron members said they attacked, and I think it was fairly effective. We were dropping 1,000-pound bombs. Mm-hmm. And I might backtrack and say one of our big missions that we participated in before we on our way down to Okinawa. Well, the Japanese had the Yamamoto in one of their northern harbors there, and they've been all sorts of information about that she was going to sail with what ships she had in support ships and try to conduct some sort of suicide mission against. They weren't quite sure what it was going to be tried against the third fleet we had there. But anyway, we were told to, Third Fleet was given the mission to attack and try to destroy the Yamamoto. So we got word that she had sorteed, and I don't recall out of what harbor, but it was one of the northern harbors there. And so we launched a strike, which I was leading the bombers off of the Intrepid. And we had the air group commander, and we went all the way up to the coast of Japan. I don't know, we had the whole group had roughly 250 planes, I think. And we searched up and down and didn't see hide the hair of them. And so we came back and dropped all of our bombs on seaplane hangars and anything we could find coming back down. But then the next day, they got pretty positive information that she had sorteed. So we launched another one, and the acting executive officer, he led that one, so he got in on the They found the Yamamoto, and they conducted. They had over 300 planes, and they did. They sunk the Yamamoto, and it was. I was sorry to have missed it.
Yeah, but, I bet that was disappointing.
Yeah, but we had sort of a gentleman's agreement. Since I was acting CO, I would take one flight and then he'd take the other. That we weren't going to hog the, wasn't going to hog the flights. So that was really the most exciting, flight that they had. And from talking with the pilots that came back, they said it was. They put up quite an AA fire. They had to go through a lot of AA fire on that, and that's pretty well covered in the chronology of the VB-10 chronology there. Mm-hmm. I know when I got out of Curie Harbor, we exited out through the northern end of it, and we had to go right through a small, almost like Point Loma there, so close together, and they had AA fire going all along from the shore at us as we were going out, and my air crewman kept hollering, says, "Put on more throttle, they're getting closer." I said, "We're going as fast as we can go." But I was very fortunate. I didn't. I got one. I think from the Curie thing, I got one burn on my side of my. Came pretty close, but that was the only. They never found any AA fire in my planes. Although some of the squadrons got some hit on it.
So after the war was over, then and y'all returned to the States.
Yes.
And where did we go from there?
Well, I took over as everybody was getting out of the service. It was just a complete exodus. You'd have. One day you would have a complete complement of officers, and the next day, within 2 or 3 days, they'd all be gone because they had their orders and there was no way you could hold them. And so I wanted to continue in aviation, but I got more orders to the navigator on this seaplane tender, and it had been assigned to... what they call the, it was going back and forth to pick up all that material and everything over in the Philippines and bring it back to the States. And they just returned and they had been through that big hurricane out there, and it had lost two of its, guarding destroyers that had been with it. Commanding officer said, I talked with him, he said he was looking back there in the waves, and the next thing he looked and they're gone, they just capsized. Mm-hmm. And, so he was a pretty nervous individual, and of course losing his navigator, and I was a new person coming aboard, I'm sure he didn't have much confidence in, but we got orders. We were up in Seattle, and we got orders to pick up one of these big Japanese seaplanes that they brought back, and they had it tied down the flight deck, looked like a spider web they had over it, and so we were to take that thing back to San Diego first. And I had 3 days in which to relieve the navigator because he was on his way. He in fact, when I got aboard, the navigator was in hack. He'd been over at the club the night before and got into a hassle with somebody in the club, and he hit, unfortunately hit the wrong person over the head with a cue stick, and that happened to be an admiral.
Poor choice.
So it was poor choice on his part. So he was summer league on his way, and I had to take over, and with very little, I had one little green ensign as my assistant. But we went back to San Diego, and then while we were there, we got orders to take the ship around to Norfolk, Virginia, and put it out of commission. And so we went down through the Panama Canal without no incidents. And the commanding officer, he was a very nervous, very extremely nervous, and I guess it was a result of his. I'd go to turn into my cabin at night, and the next morning I'd get up and I'd find we were 10 or 15 degrees off of the course we were steering the night before, and I'd want to know what's going on. He'd say, well, the commanding officer would get up every night and about every hour, and he'd tell me change the course 1 degree to the right.
It's kind of dangerous.
Oh, very dangerous. But in all those little islands down there, he'd if we was passing within 3 or 4 miles of them, he'd get shook up and keep easing off. We got through the straits down in Guantanamo there. We were supposed to pick up the lighthouse about 6 o'clock in the morning, and he was ready to reverse course and turn back when he finally picked it up. But we got into Norfolk, and he received his orders immediately to some other place, and I remember I flew him up from Norfolk to Anacostia, you know, the old, mm-hmm. up in Washington, and we were making our approach to the Anacostia Air Station there over the Potomac River, and he called me up over the interphone and says, we can't go over that Potomac River. And I said, why not, Captain? He says, well, I don't have any life jacket on. I just hung up the intercom, and I didn't listen to any further conversations. But he was very, very nervous. But anyway, I ended up with everybody on. I was the air officer, and then I became the executive officer, and putting this thing out of commission, and it was a chore because all these kids were leaving, and they didn't want to go through any hassle about putting these things in the mothballs. Well, when I was just getting ready to be dumped on as the commanding officer of this thing, I got my orders to emergency orders to transfer over as navigator of the USS Pine Island, which was going on a Arctic cruise north. And I jumped at that and went, and the commanding officer was Captain Alan Smith, who later made admiral. Very fine gentleman. And we went up through the Davis Strait, and our mission was really to establish a base. I think it was primarily a radar base at Thule, Greenland.
Right.
And then we were to go on up through the in to see if we could find a passageway through the north, through the Lancaster Sound. And we spent about a couple of months up there. It's a wonder we didn't run aground. We went in through one little cove one night and anchored and got up the next morning, and there was a big iceberg lying right across the entrance to the sound. And we didn't know whether we was ever going to make it out of there or not, but it finally drifted on out. But I spent about 3 or 4 months.
That looks familiar.
Oh, yes. PBM Martin. Pine Island. Yep, that was the old ship I was navigator of.
Sorry to interrupt you, but
no, that's all right.
I just thought about.
But anyway, we got back to Norfolk, and I was still hoping that I would get an assignment back to a squadron, and they were forming the Antarctic expedition at the time, and everything had already been set. The ship's complement, the navigators, and so forth and so on. And so I was sitting around in the wardroom congratulating, said, well, I won't have to make that trip. And about that time, they delivered a dispatch, says, you have emergency orders to go to navigator of the USS Norton Sound. And so... Let's see now. Am I getting the Norton Sound and the Pine Island mixed up here? Maybe the Norton Sound was. I think Norton Sound was when we went north on the Norton Sound, and then I got orders to Pine Island. The Pine Island made the Antarctic cruise. Yeah, I think it's Pine Island. Pine Island was on the Antarctic cruise. Mm-hmm. And Norton Sound was the one that went to the Northern Cruise.
Well, did you know Edward Walker? Ed Walker?
No.
He was on the Pine Island on that Arctic cruise.
Oh, was he?
That's where these pictures came from.
On the 1947?
And maybe he made more than one.
I don't know whether he made. No, I don't think there's more than one. Was he a pilot of one of them?
This was Operations High Jump 47.
Yeah, that's what I was on. Yes, that's quite odd. And he wasn't Walker? What was his?
I don't know what his rank was at that time. He retired as a rear admiral. This is Ed Walker, Jr., senior.
Just cogitate a little bit. Captain Caldwell was the commanding officer of there, and he went on to make admiral. And his executive officer was Commander Swartz. And the Pine Island was the task group flagship and we went down. In fact, I've got the chart of the track chart that we went through the whole thing. But Walker,
was just an aside.
Yeah,
I don't know.
Well, anyway, we arrived. I got my orders, and what had happened is that the navigator that had been assigned to navigate the Pine Island had went up and told the commanding officer the day before I got my orders that he didn't feel qualified to navigate, and that he would be happy to volunteer as a first lieutenant of the ship, but he didn't want to navigate, and so commanding officer had no alternative except to go and request the replacement. And of course, I was very conveniently sitting about four or five ships over.
And you had just returned from the opposite direction.
So I found myself getting in the longboat and going over and reporting aboard the Long Island, or rather the Pine Island. And we got underway 2 days after I was aboard. We got underway and went back down through the Panama Canal and headed south. Arrived in the first iceberg at the Antarctic on Christmas Day, and we set up. The whole object of that whole thing was to make an aerial map of the whole Antarctic. And of course, the Pine Island received quite a bit of notoriety is when we one of the planes crashed over on the.
There are photographs of that plane crash in that collection.
Is that right? Well, Captain Caldwell was was a passenger on that flight. He had went along. He'd went along as an observer, and so we had a lot of trepidations. We didn't know for a long time whether we were going to be able to recover him or not. And it was pretty hairy operations. We had absolutely no navigation aids down here, except we could get sun lines, and that was about it. And it was, we couldn't see, you know.
Now, what time of year was this?
This was in January and February.
Okay. And you'd been at the Arctic earlier that same year, when it was, I presume, the warmest time in the Arctic, and then you came right on
down to the. And we spent from Christmas Day. We spent. We left there about March 1st, so we were there pretty much about 3 months. We were down operating off of the Antarctic.
How successful could you be in mapping an area that's nothing but ice?
Well, they apparently were able to get good aerial photographs. In fact, they found a lot of things there that they never even thought or knew existed. Like they found warm water springs and things in there that, in fact, when they were making their trek back out of there, apparently got involved in some of those areas where the ice had melted away.
Well, compare the navigational problems of that voyage and your Arctic voyage. Was it the same type of problems that you were facing?
No, we had a little better. The navigation up in the Arctic, we had they had some direction finder stations, a couple of direction finder stations up there, which we were able to use, and of course we didn't have the ice to contend with. The Arctic was nothing but, we could go in so far, and then the whole thing was just rimmed with ice caps, icebergs. I can remember seeing as many as 80 icebergs on the horizon at one time, it was just continually evading icebergs. We stayed there and had to leave because the water started freezing over, and we were at sea from the time when we came back. After we left the Antarctic, we stopped back in Rio de Janeiro and then went on to San Diego.
Now, were you being escorted by any icebreakers or any other kind of ships like
not
that?
Not icebreakers.
Just the Pine Island by itself.
No, we had a destroyer with us. And the USS, I remember USS Bronson, we had the destroyer. And that was a sort of a musing incident that happened when we were Captain Dufek was the task group. Admiral Byrd was supposed to be in charge, but actually Captain Dufek was a senior captain of the whole group, and he was really the operational commander, he decided to pay a social call on the commanding officer of the Bronson one day. So only way they can get over there, of course, was by high line. So they rigged up a high line, and right in the middle, he had him right in the middle when they got a good wave surge, and the two ships started apart, and then instead of letting the line ease out, first lieutenant who I had relieved as navigator, and he took over as first lieutenant, he held the line, the bite, and then of course the line just parted and flipped. The Captain Dufac made about 3 gainers and came down in the water.
Didn't last long in the war around there either.
No, he didn't. The destroyer, from the time is when he hit the water, they broke away and he was in the water only 7 minutes till they had him out.
Wow.
And they came back and picked him up.
I mean, that was uncomfortable fall concern.
And that was his second experience. He went out on an ice patrol with the helicopter, and they got back hovering right over the ship when the rotors iced up, and he had to make a landing in the water right off the ship. And his comment was to the pilot was, you didn't say by your leave, you just stepped on my head and went out first. No, he got dunked twice down while we were down there.
Wow.
But we ran in some communist activity when we got back to Rio de Janeiro, and the head of the vice squad had been put in charge of our reception committee, and he took the commanding officers over to one of his houses of ill repute, and they didn't know they were going there, and they lined all their caps up and took pictures of them and forwarded them back to the States. And when we got back, we were put in quarantine for 3 days for an official investigation of our conduct in Rio de Janeiro.
Yeah.
But we couldn't even go back. We'd been at sea almost for 6 months. We were quarantined for 3 days after we got back in San Diego. That was, of course, everything was cleared up. They were just trying to stir up trouble.
Mm-hmm.
But from the Pine Island, I was ordered, I thought I was going to have to make another trip, go to China, and my commanding officer, previous commanding officer of the Norton Sound, Captain Smith, had told me, he says, anytime you won't need any help, let me know. And so three or 4 days before we were sailed for China, I sent him a help. I said, I need some help. And I said, I need some orders. He says, he immediately sent back and says, where do you want to go? And I said, Patuxent River. And so I had ordered Patuxent River the next morning.
You weren't anxious to return to China? Yet.
No, I wasn't anxious to go anywhere on that ship. And so I got my orders to Patuxent River, and I spent, I was assigned to the service test division there, and primarily involved with the carrier attacked aircraft, and spent 2.5 years there from 47 through 49, I guess, through 50. And then I was getting a little, I still wanted to get back into the fleet, and I was hoping to get back to a squadron. And so my director caught me up in the air one day and says, I've got a hot project. They've asked me to get a unattached bachelor, and I wasn't married at the time, says, unattached bachelor who can go on a secret mission. And and said, I need an answer right away. And I said, well, I'm not so sure. Let me think about it. So I flew around for about 30 minutes, and I said, okay. I says, he still wouldn't tell me what it was. He didn't say he didn't know. Well, I volunteered, and that was the last time I ever volunteered for anything, because it turned out to be an assignment over in the United Nations over in Kashmir in India. And I spent 6 months over there, became the most proficient Jeep driver in the Navy, probably.
What was your assignment?
I was assigned to the U.S. UN Military Observer Group, you know, between the Indian and the Indian and Pakistani army. You know, they'd gone to war over Kashmir. Still at war, I think. I don't think they've ever solved it. But I spent three months in the field with the Indian Army, and then I spent 3 months up at headquarters in Srinagar, which is up in Kashmir. And then when the Korean War broke out, I received orders back to sign to Attack Squadron 45, which was in Norfolk.
But there, when you were in the Kashmir area, really nothing, nothing
it
that
was
worth reporting on?
It was just, I tell you, it was, we were signed at headquarters, and we had to go out and investigate. Like we were in pairs, you know, we would be signed out of pairs, and there was UN observers. We had about 50 observers, and they were in different stations all up and down the ceasefire line. I was down in Jammu, India, up in the hills there with the at the headquarters of the Indian general in that area. And all we did was get these stupid complaints about somebody had shot somebody, and we'd get in our jeep with some young Indian lieutenant who would take us on a wild goose chase up and down mountains, and his whole objective, I think, was see if he could wear us out, because it was never where we could take the jeep. We had to walk about two-thirds of the way, and a couple of times we had to dig up a corpse or something like that to verify that he'd been shot, but it was
no treachery.
No, those people were, I don't think they really wanted to fight. They just, but they had a ceasefire along there, and I don't know. I think they still have it. I think they still have a ceasefire over there. And Kashmir is still governed by India, I think. And I didn't relish that duty at all. It was, I must admit, I was in the best shape of my life when I came back. But I was about 200 miles up from Jammu, and we'd make a trip down the jeep over those mountain trails about once every couple of weeks to pick up our mail, and I'd fly with the Air Force down to New Delhi, pick up supplies, get my flight time in, and made a trip over to the Philippines. And about the only interesting thing there, we landed over in right before the French had been kicked Indochina. What was that? Saigon. We landed in Saigon, and they invited us up. The French there invited us up to have lunch with them, the Air Force captain was in charge of the airplane, and I was flying as his co-pilot, and I said, I don't really think I want to go. And he said, oh, come on. And they were making attacks, you know. The French were sending out their planes, and you could hear them making attacks against the Vietnamese there. And so finally we went and we had lunch, and after the wine was flowing, and I thought to myself, I said, they're never going to last in this. And sure enough, and I could see they were being served by these Vietnamese waiters, and you could just see the hate oozing out of their faces when they looked at these people. And I said, I don't think it'll last very long, which it didn't. Mm-hmm. And they were kicked out shortly after that. But generally, my experience with the UN wasn't. I don't have much a very good opinion of the UN. but anyway, I got. If you want to hear any more,
Korea. You said you were appointed to attack squadron.
Yeah, I went back to PA-45 as executive officer and spent about a month and a half there, and then I got orders to commanding officer of the A-175, which was operating out of Jacksonville, and I was commanding officer about it. Year and a little over a year, and we were signed to the Roosevelt in the Midway. We made a couple of deployments out in the Mediterranean, and when I was relieved of that, I received orders as training officer down in at Barron Field in Pensacola, Florida. Spent